You're listening to a podcast from funnyinthemiddle.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this, we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on funnyinthemiddle.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking, on with the podcast. Welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Colin, and with me are my comrades and co-hosts, Tracy.
Hey.
And Ian.
Hello.
Each episode, we take a letter of the alphabet and pick two bands, one well-known, one less so, and talk about what we like, what we don't like, and anything in between. It's episode 6 today, so that means we've got to the letter F. So today, we shall be talking about Fear Factory and Fleetwood Mac.
Unlikely bedfellows.
Dream combo.
If they were to tour, I would go. I like both bands.
I imagine that Fleetwood Mac fans would be as tolerant, if not less tolerant, than Black Sabbath fans were to Fear Factory.
Quite possibly. Ian, that's Fear Factory, one of your picks. Do you want to go with the...
Indeed I do.
Tell us about Fear
Factory.
Yes,
okay.
Due to the graphic nature of this program, listener discretion is advised.
They formed in 89. They're classified as an industrial metal band, which I would absolutely go with, although they have been given the labels of nu metal, which is maybe for like one album, death metal, first album.
Yeah.
Groove metal and thrash metal, I think, are a bit of a reach.
I would go with groove.
Yeah.
Okay.
They have got a fairly checkered lineup past, which we will discuss no doubt later on. But obviously the original dream lineup, whatever, is Burton Sobel on vocals, Dino Cazares on guitar, Christian Oldwolvers, although only from second album onwards, and yeah. Shives on the first album, on bass, and Raymond Herrera, the human drum machine.
Yes.
A man that they could only replace with the absolute epic monster that is Gene Hoglan.
Yes.
So, you know. They've had many albums. Many, because I like about 8, I reckon.
Maybe not. Sounds about right. Something
yeah.
like that.
Not counting
remixes. Or was that counting remix albums?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
No. Then The Manufacturer, I believe, is the album that we both started on.
Yes.
And Tracy has started on none of the albums, I believe.
About that, yeah. No, I hadn't heard of them before.
So, I think, personally, that they were absolutely responsible for every other motherfucker in the 90s having big soaring melodic choruses on their metal band. So, like, metal songs.
I could see that.
But when I heard Replica, I had not heard shouty vocals combined with big powerful singing.
I can't think of anything before that. If I,
yeah. From interviewing Dino on a couple of occasions, I think he thinks that as well.
Right.
Well, I don't think he thinks that. I know he thinks
yes.
that. He's not bitter about
right,
it
yeah.
at all. But yeah.
He possibly likes the acknowledgement though, because they don't get
They
much
don't
mention.
No.
that for us in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, in the metal scene, they were big.
Yeah, massive.
You know, they weren't headlining stadiums or anything, but they were well known enough, and they were selling a lot of T-shirts and records.
And for me as well, the thing that really captured me is that they got a narrative going on from the off. Yeah. Not like an obvious theme. It wasn't concept albums, but they were like, imagine if Terminator was real. What happens if we sounded like Terminator was real? That's basically...
With a bit of Blade Runner.
Yes. A little bit of Blade... Latest album, definitely.
What if Terminator turned up in the Blade Runner universe, basically?
Yep. And then we soundtracked it, and we hung out with Reese Fulwer from Frontline Assembly.
Yeah.
So basically got my vote straight away. The first openly, definitely sci-fi metal band, yeah. I think. I mean, like Meshuggah are probably in the ballpark as well.
Say, Meshuggah are the second and possibly last.
Yeah. And I don't. I'm happy with that. That's fine.
Right.
I'm excited by it. I like a bit of narrative and a bit of concept behind your music. Not necessarily, as I say, not necessarily concept albums.
Yeah.
Just like, this is what we do. We have a theme.
But the music sounds like the theme as well.
Yes.
It sounds like Angry Machines.
It does. It does. This is why Digimortal is my favourite album production-wise, because the drums are super compressed and really drum machine sounding.
Yeah.
That's what I thought they were going for.
Right.
You know, as inhuman as possible.
A bit like bit crushing on there or something.
No, it's super drum machine-y.
Yeah, yeah.
Like very, very...
precise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously Ray's drumming is super precise anyway.
Yeah.
But if you reduce the sounds to just drum machine sounds...
Yeah.
As much as possible, then yeah. Although everyone's doing that now. Everyone uses triggered drum sounds now.
Yeah.
There's another thing. Maybe they did that too. Who knows?
Now, I mean, the first album was fairly straight death metal.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
there were some samples and.
Is that the one that Replica's on?
No, that's on Demanufacture.
It's what did I put on the second?
Scapegoat.
Yeah, Scapegoat.
Although it's not Scapegoat Pigfoot Mix.
No, the other version of Scapegoat.
David Cameron's favourite.
I've heard he is a big Fear Factory fan.
But it's that one with the amazingly catchy tune of chorus of Suffer Bastard.
Yeah.
I read something about that Scapegoat song that said it's the Cookie Monster singing on it.
Well,
it is.
You do get that a lot in death metal. That was a fairly constant...
Yeah.
Kind of.
He progressed quite, because his melodic vocals were a bit weak on that album.
Yeah.
The melodic vocals from Demanufacture onwards, I was thinking about it on the drive over, and they're almost like Gregorian Monk kind of sounding.
He's got a side. Well, he did a side project called Ascension of the Watchers, which was a mostly electronic thing.
Right.
And his vocals on that. I don't want to stray into Tracy territory and steal one of her words, but they are haunting on there.
Are they ethereal?
Yes, again, quite ethereal and haunting. Which I think juxtaposes quite lovely. Quite lovelily.
Lovely.
Fuck! Juxtaposed, great word, lovelily, stupid word.
Until they leave you breathless
Which
and dizzy.
Is actually a splendid juxtaposition, so
it is.
I'm back
it
on
is.
Track now.
Boom.
I think... Yeah, the melodic vocals and the harshness of his shouty vocals work really, really well.
It's a good contrast.
They're unashamedly melodic in places, aren't they?
Oh, definitely.
Not necessarily in the music, but the vocals.
Well, the music can be as well.
You're going to go to Descent, aren't you?
This Descent is, you know, Replicas.
Yeah.
Very melodic.
Yeah, this is true.
But Descent is almost like a sort of pop song. It's still very heavy.
Yeah.
I think... I have distorted my perception over the years, so I will hear something that's ridiculously heavy but has got like melodic elements to it, and in my head that goes pop song.
Yeah.
And then I'll play it to someone like my dad and he'll go, what is this?
Yeah.
Because it particularly can't see past the heaviness of it. But I mean, on the latest album, Genexus.
Yeah.
Or Genexus.
It's Genexus.
Genexus. There's a track called Regenerate on there,
so
which
good,
is a massive pop song. It's amazing, but it's still heavy as fuck. But going back to where I was talking about the melodic stuff, you've got on Obsolete, which was the third proper album.
Yes. That was the one that could be just about in the
new metal-ish
because it was Cypress Hill were on it, for God's sake.
Yeah, but it was mainly because it was at that time.
Yeah. And they all cut their hair short for it.
Yes. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. I'd completely forgotten that they did a load.
Yeah.
But they, you've actually thrown me with that because I've just had flashbacks of, oh shit, yeah, look at that.
Yeah.
Which was a big thing in metal back in the day.
Yeah.
It's like Rastafarianism. Do not cut off your natty dread and all that. But yeah, there's Resurrection and Timelessness, which are the last two songs. Are progressively more melodic. Resurrection's very melodic, but still retaining sort of heavy elements. But then Timelessness, the last song, is just synth and vocals, basically.
Yeah, pretty much.
And he's, you know, really, really... It could be a Depeche Mode track.
It could. But, the last track on Demanufacture, Therapy for Pain, that's just great.
Yeah.
That reminds me of Yaesu, actually. I've only just made the connection, but...
That's a fair point, because Justin Broderick in Godflesh and Head of David was a massive influence on Fear Factory.
Well, yeah, because that album, Demanufacture, has got a cover of Dog Day Sunrise on it.
Yes, by Head of David.
Yeah, so...
I did think about this the other day. Fear Factory, we're recording this now in Birmingham.
Yeah.
Fear Factory would not exist. They're from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
They would not exist if it was not for Birmingham, because arguably two of their biggest influences are Godflesh.
For sure.
Napalm Death.
In fact, three of their biggest influences, because Black Sabbath as well, because they're a metal band.
Yeah.
And you can't have metal bands without Black Sabbath.
Indeed. So, thank you. No, you should thank us.
Yes. We are Birmingham. We are important for metal.
Remember from talking to him. I know I'm really focusing on the fact that I interviewed the guy, but like,
it's a good source to.
It is,
you know.
It is. I asked him about the songwriting because I always do.
Yeah.
Because I'm fascinated with how different people write songs.
Yeah.
Because there are so many different approaches, and what he writes all of the music. I think he does most of the drums as well, just programs them in MIDI. But he also writes the song titles.
Okay. And then
passes them to Burton, who writes lyrics
to the song titles.
Yeah, which is weird for me. I've never even thought about doing that.
Yeah.
I was like, well, for serious? That's how you do that? That's strange.
Burton, this one's called Piss Christ. Write Piss Christ.
Yeah. I imagine that was quite easy for him. He's not a fan of religion, so...
No.
Super easy. But yeah, this one's called Anodongs, which is a finish that you do to aluminium.
Yes.
Can you imagine? It's just like, how do I make that sound? What? I don't. I'm just going to write some lyrics and then just scream the word Anodongs every now and again.
I will write a song about an angry machine, that will do.
Yeah. You've done that on the last five albums, but...
It's worked.
We're called Fear Factory. But... the middle period, they got hilariously EastEnders.
Okay.
I keep promising to tell you this one.
Yeah.
And I've been holding off just because it's better for the record. But they, so, Dino left.
Yeah.
Really, really, like, it was quite a bad split. And Christian came, the guitarist. And
so I moved from bass to guitar.
Yeah. Lauren Stroud from Strapping Young Lad came and played bass.
Right.
Hence, there's a big, I guess, Strapping Young Lad are also a sci-fi metal band.
They are. That is a fair point.
Obviously, later replacing Raymond with Gene Hoglund.
Yeah.
But then, right, then Christian and Raymond formed another band called Archaea, who you will not have heard of, despite the hilarious dick move that they did. Because they had, evidently one of them had got the login details for the website. So they just took loads of Fear Factory stuff off the website, loads of links to their new band. And Fear Factory at that point in time had then gone, well, fuck you guys. Dino was back in the band, and they'd got Gene Hoglan from Strapping playing drums.
Yeah.
Tony Campos from Static X playing bass.
Yeah.
And they'd written a new album, and they'd put it out on Candlelight, so obviously a much smaller label than Roadrunner. But they couldn't promote it at all, because their own website was promoting this dog shit band that no one's ever heard of. It's madness, isn't it? And then they were on tour, and their tour bus caught fire.
Okay.
This is all happens at once, so on the motorway.
Was Christian Oldiewolbers seen running from the scene with a can of match? Can of petrol?
Well, you know, he was heavily connected with like Cypress Hill and the whole Soul Assassins gangster thing, Who knows? I'm not saying he did. He was in the UK, though, so...
Yeah, probably not, though, for legal reasons.
So, obviously, this topic never came up in my interview because it seemed like it would be a bit of a sore one. Right? So what about that time those ex-members dicked you over, advertised their own band on your website, and then your tour bus burnt down when you were on tour? Talk me through that.
Two things you mentioned there that I wanted to go back to that I thought about. The melodic but heavy type stuff in a lot of circumstances reminds me of Devin Townsend's Ocean Machine album.
Mm.
Devin Townsend is also Strapping Young Lad, is his metal band.
Yes.
Ocean Machine was sort of a bit more of melodic prog metal kind.
He supported himself with that.
Yes. Yeah, he has lots of different projects and stuff.
Regularly supports
him. I was going to say, Zimmer's Hole have supported Strapping Young Lad.
That's a Strapping Young Lad side project, not a Devin side project.
Ah, right, I knew he was connected in some way. One of the things I was thinking about while I was looking into all this kind of thing is, first album, fairly straightforward death metal. The next album is a lot more industrial.
Yeah.
And they go along a more industrial route because they brought Reese Fulber from Frontline Assembly, who are an industrial metal band. It's not long after Frontline Assembly released Millennium.
Yes.
Which has got loads. I mean, it's got, you can play Spot the Riff on that album.
You really can.
It's got Pantera riffs, Metallica riffs, Sepultura riffs.
Although officially the Metallica riffs were played by Devin Townsend on James Hetfield's guitar amp.
Right, okay.
Because that was the story at the time. Their record label wouldn't give them permission to use it.
Okay.
So Hetfield went, borrow my amps and guitars. Record some things that sound similar.
Yeah.
And Devin Townsend went, yeah, man. And they totally didn't sample the Black Album at all. They just got very remarkably similar production.
I think quite a few of them are replayed riffs rather than straight samples.
I'm reasonably certain there's samples, but
yeah, I think there's some just legally speaking. I think Reese Fulber is probably very, very important to the sound.
Well, he's the one that produced Digimortal, which is why it sounds like that.
What did he do production on Demanufacture as well?
Keyboards and samples.
Right. Okay. Excellent.
So I guess maybe a co-producer credit at the most.
Yeah. But then you mentioned Roadrunner Records. Late 90s, as a metal kid, Roadrunner Records was like a mark of quality, even.
Yeah.
That's
it. If you got a tape and that tape was black, because Roadrunner tapes were always black.
Yeah, yeah, I had a Shelter album on a black cassette. You know, they had Sepultura, Typo Negative.
All of my tapes were black.
Machine Head.
Yeah.
And they used to release these videos called Drilling the Vein, which were just a compilation of their music videos and that sort of thing. And they were great. I used to have a purple tie-dye Demanufacture t-shirt.
Nice.
Which was amazing.
I used to have a little Fear Factory logo necklace. I
remember that.
Yeah.
Tracy, any sort of thoughts?
Well, I don't have many frames of reference for them because I used to listen to a lot of thrash and death metal back in the late 80s. I used to go to thrash all day, as in Birmingham, with my younger brother. But I don't, since then, you know, not so much, you know, I'm happier listening to folk and country, to be honest now. But I mean, when I was listening to the soundtrack, that the playlist that Ian did, and I was listening to Autonomous Combat System, I think the track was. I mean, that
which
one
is the opening track on Genexus.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
That one did send me off on a Sepultura tangent. And not necessarily saying they sound like each other, it just made me want to go and listen to Sepultura. And that's not a bad thing. And then there's that one, Replica. It made me think of Anthrax, Indians.
Okay.
It's the drumming, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm insane.
With like the double kicks here.
But yeah, epic drumming. So, much more melodic than Anthrax, obviously. But
I mean, Anthrax don't have enough bits to go,
No, everyone needs a
But no, I thought Fear Factory had some like really good contrasts. They mix the styles up a lot. You know, the big melodic choruses and the insanely brutal drums. And they're so industrial. I mean, there was one I was listening to and I thought it was almost, I don't know, it sounded like something like Front 242.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I can definitely see that. The sort of whole electronic side of things, there was a really short period of time in about 98-ish, where suddenly all of the metal bands started releasing remix albums and remixes on B-sides.
Yeah.
So you'd got Remanufacture, and then there was also White Zombie did Super Sexy Swinging Sounds.
They did another one after that as well, I think. Rob Zombie's.
Yeah. There was Korn had a load of remixes on the Adidas and Good God single B-sides.
Metallica had a Moby remix.
Yeah, well, this is what I was going to say. The Spawn soundtrack.
Yeah, the Spawn soundtrack was it. Like Judgment Night kicked off a lot of rap metal. The Spawn soundtrack was like massive. Well,
it was all collaboration, so you've got people like
Atari Teenage Riot and Slayer.
Yes.
That's the most brutal one.
Oh, Remorso, I want to die!
Yeah, Slayer hate that, apparently. But, yeah, there was loads. Filter and Crystal Method, wasn't it?
Yeah, can't
show that. That's fucking great.
It was a really good album. Korn and the Dust Brothers, Kick PA.
Yep.
Marilyn Manson and the Sneaker Pimps, which there was some kind of weird legal disagreement between the two.
Was there?
And I've got a feeling that they had to remix it on later versions or something.
Mm.
And it ended up not going on a compilation later on for that reason. I can't remember the full details. But yeah, Marilyn Manson had also done the remix and Repent EP.
Yeah.
And it was really strange because it was just in a really short period of time.
I reckon it's Earache that kicked all that off though, because Earache did a horrific, like brutal Gabberon Napalm, like there was like Napalm Death, Berserker, Ultraviolence, everything like that, because they'd always had a strong
rhythm. They got the Gabber side, hadn't they?
Ultraviolence, Delta Nine, stuff like that. And it was a truly horrific time in a great way for really brutally electronic metal collaboration.
I mean, you've got the T-1000 on the Remanufacture.
That is, yeah.
Which is, it's just straight Gabba. Well, it's Gabba. It's just the distorted, bassy kick drum just going... kind of thing. Which is what... I went on a school German exchange in 1995, and that was what was all the Germans were listening to. Was... It's really bizarre. You've got in their charts at the time in Germany, you've got I Want to Be a Hippie by Technohead about 3 years before it was a hit over here.
Oh, Technohead are actually brutal. Technohead remixes of Misery Loves Company songs, and they're just so hard.
But then you'd also, in the charts at the same time over there, you'd got Rage. Not Rage Against the Machine.
Oh no, Rage the metal.
Rage the power metal band.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there going, this is a thoroughly strange chart.
Yep, but no,
I quite like it.
It's just like listening to Earache's back catalogue.
But there were kids that I went to school with at the same time. So in 98 I was 16, And there were kids that were going to these like raves and stuff, like Helter Skelter and stuff like that, where they were getting the tapes that came in the really big plastic box.
Yeah, yeah.
And it almost seemed like it was a crossover with that kind of thing, but it was all American bands. I mean, you said it was like Earache kicked it off, but Epic Records seemed to be doing a lot of it with like Korn, and they released the Spawn soundtrack. But then it was such a short period of time, and then Fear Factory haven't done another remix album since then.
No, and I wish they would, but yeah. I don't think the record company would give them budget for it.
That's,
I get the impression that that's the issue.
Yeah.
Because there's probably not a market for it.
But their new album is so good. I mean, it's not new now, it's a couple of years old, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's Genexus. I mean, if we hadn't... the last album I properly listened to by Fear Factory was Digimortal, which was God, 16 years ago, something like that.
I faded out a lot for the old Wolvers years as guitarist, because they became really, really generic, and it was a bit disappointing. And then I got a promo through going, hey, check out the new Fear Factory album. This is what's happened. This is Mechanoise. And I was like, shit! Because the opening track just rips your fucking face off. And I was like, they're back! That's what I wanted! That's precisely what I wanted.
Awesome.
And I've been back in the Fear Factory camp ever since.
Yeah, I think I'm back there. I actually nearly went to see them a couple of years ago when I was on my honeymoon with my wife. I was looking for gigs while we were over there, and found Fear Factory and Cold Chamber were...
that would have been fun.
I think they were playing the House of Blues in Disneyland, and I was like, got to go to that, that'd be amazing. And then we found that Jenny Lewis was playing the same night, which my wife would have actually enjoyed, rather than going, this is just noise. So we went to that, which turned out to be the best gig I've ever been to.
Weirdly, my first official tagging each other Facebook date with my girlfriend was to Fear Factory when they did the Demanufacture 20 year anniversary show.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Excellent. So, shall we...
Intrinsically linked in my relationship.
I think on that note, shall we move on to the next band then?
Yes.
Talk about Fleetwood Mac. Slightly different.
Yeah, Fear Factory.
Even less to say about than I did about Fear Factory.
This is going to be a short episode.
Rock cocaine enthusiasts Fleetwood Mac have a very complicated history. Started in 1966 when guitarist Peter Green replaced Eric Clapton in John Mayall's Blues Breakers. The following year, Green recorded an instrumental demo with the band's rhythm section, drummer Mick Fleetwood and bassist John McVie, naming the track Fleetwood Mac after his bandmates. The three of them left the Blues Breakers not long afterwards and recruited singer guitarist Jeremy Spencer, closely followed by Danny Kirwan as a third guitarist. Peter Green left the band in 1970 after being spiked with acid on tour and essentially losing his mind. Then John McVie's wife Christine McVie joined on keyboards and vocals before Jeremy Spencer went missing while on tour. Oh, we'll talk about that in a bit.
Okay.
That is actually a really interesting sort of point. After a few more years of lineup changes and various album releases and that kind of thing, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks were recruited, and they became one of the biggest pop rock bands in the universe, with their 1977 album Rumours selling over 40 million copies worldwide, making it the 8th biggest selling album of all time.
Wow.
Which is, it's a ridiculous number of albums if you think about it. It's just behind Saturday Night Fever and a lot better. They're a weird one, Fleetwood Mac, because they're essentially... So I was going to say two different bands, but they're way more than two different bands if you talk about all the ones in between the Peter Green era and the Stevie Nicks, Lindsey Buckingham era.
Yeah.
But the bits in the middle, I've never really got into, so sort of ignore that. So you've got like the Peter Green sort of blues rock kind of, it started off really straight blues.
Yeah.
I mean, when he joined, he replaced Eric Clapton in the Blues Breakers, and he was so straight away stepping into Eric Clapton's shoes at that time, 1966. That was when you'd got, just before that, you'd got all the Clapton is God graffiti all over the place. He was seen as, you know, the best guitarist in the universe. Peter Green then took over from him. That's pretty big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
You know, this was still pre Hendrix. Nobody knew who Hendrix was yet. And then, I mean, they did tracks like Green Man Alishi is almost proto-metal.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that before yesterday. Yeah. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I liked that.
Well, Judas Priest.
Dirty, bluesy guitars.
Yeah. And this, Oh Well, absolutely amazing riff, which is it's normally the first riff my dad plays whenever he picks up a guitar.
Yeah.
Has been for 30 odd years at least. But for me, I'm a guitarist, I love the Peter Green stuff, but I really, really, really love the pop stuff from when Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham joined.
I think, honestly, that's probably the bit I'm more familiar with.
Yes. I think it probably is for a lot of people, particularly these days.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few really big hits from the Peter Green stuff. I mean, Black Magic Woman, everybody probably knows the Santana version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Better than that. Everyone knows Albatross, if only for it being on Marks and Spencer's adverts.
Yeah.
And for being epically dull.
It's
Boss covered Albatross.
Okay. So I saw that Bosk had played Albatross. I didn't know it was a cover. I thought they'd got their own song called Albatross. If it was a cover, I would have imagined it would be much more likely to be Corrosion of Conformity's Albatross.
Yeah, yeah. But no.
I'm going to need to hear that. That sounds amazing. I love Bosk. But Man of the World is a great song. But then the run of three albums, Fleetwood Mac self-titled, which was actually something like their 11th album, and then obviously Rumours, and then Tusk are amazing. I mean, Tusk would have been better cut down a lot. It was, the cocaine had gone slightly to their heads at that point, and it was Lindsey Buckingham needed an editor at that point. And he'd sort of taken over the band a little bit.
Yeah.
But going back to what I said earlier about Jeremy... I've completely blanked on his name.
Oh, no.
Jeremy Spencer, who was their sort of original singer. They were on tour in Los Angeles.
Right.
And he was at the hotel one day and just said, oh, I'm just nipping to the shop.
Yeah,
and just disappeared. And they were I think they got three nights at somewhere like the Whiskey A Go-Go booked, or the Troubadour or somewhere like that, and obviously had to cancel these dates and were frantically trying to find out where he is, and it turned out he'd been picked up by the Children of God cult.
What?
Who were a religious cult. They're still going. They're now known as the Family International.
Oh.
But in the 70s, they were the Children of God, and they were... It was not long after the Manson family and that kind of thing. There were a lot of LA-based religious nutters.
Yeah.
They believed that the apocalypse was on its way. They were basically a sex cult, which unfortunately they didn't limit that to the adults in the cult.
Oh dear.
Which is not obviously good.
Mm.
And they did a lot of very, very fucked up shit. And he's still a member now.
Wow.
Right.
I believe they've stopped the paedophilia.
Well, that's good.
But there was... if anybody, you know, if you want to listen to more stuff about that, if you want to know more about the Children of God cult, there was a Last Podcast on the Left episode about it, and it's absolutely fascinating, because there was one guy who basically later on, when he grew up, came back and shot a load of them before killing himself.
Wow.
And a guy from Fleetwood Mac joined. Which is, the closest thing I can think of to that is like this one of the Wilson brothers from the Beach Boys. Was it Dennis Wilson that got in with Charles Manson and the family?
Yeah.
And basically invited them all round to his house. They all got there's a Charles Manson song on a Beach Boys album as Hard to Resist. Was originally called Cease to Exist and was written by Charles Manson.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yep. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
They are, of course, not condoning cults.
No, I've never joined one.
Unless it's Cult of Luna.
Cult of Luna, they're the best one.
Yes, but in general, bad. Bad yes. idea.
The cult, they're alright.
We don't have direct experience with any cults other than of Luna and the...
The cult, yes. The occult, that's pretty cool.
Not Yakult, though.
No, Yakult, no. We did that one the other week.
We did. I like to hark back to things.
Excellent. It's like a callback to the Mighty Boosh joke that you nicked last time.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent.
Recycling stolen joke.
Listeners, if any of you are in a religious cult, get out.
Yes, please.
And on that note, let's go to talk about Fleetwood Mac.
Yes, let's do that.
Shall we?
Let's talk a bit more about what we were actually talking
about. Circle back round to the original.
But it was almost like they were cursed. There's a lot of people that said that the band were cursed because Peter Green basically completely losing his mind. They just played a gig in Hamburg somewhere and somebody spiked his drink with a massive amount of LSD. And he was never the same again. He basically fell out with the rest of the band because he then decided he wanted to donate all of the money that the band ever earned to charity, and they were like, we want to pay our rent,
yeah,
and no. that kind of thing, and left not long after. But the mid 70s onwards, when you've got, I mean, the way it works is they needed a new guitarist. John McVie and Mick Fleetwood were looking for a new guitarist, and they were in, I think they were at Sound City Studios in LA, and they heard this album called Buckingham Nicks, which was by Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks. For anybody that's listening that's not sure, Lindsey Buckingham is the man, Stevie Nicks is the lady. When I was about six, I could not get my head around that.
No, it's
like they've got the opposite names. What's going on there?
It is weird.
It is. But the Buckingham Nicks album is really, really good. Yep. It's never been re-released, so it's never been issued on CD. So it was only released at the time on vinyl. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of my holy grails for years that I just had to get hold of. And I managed to find it in a random shop in Sheldon a while back. Mm. And it's, yeah, it was worth the wait. It's really good. But they totally sort of... You can tell that they completely transformed the songwriting of the band,
yeah,
because it's a completely different style and it's a much more sort of American pop. It's, you know, similar to, you've got bits of stuff like the Eagles in there,
yeah,
only not shit, because I hate the Eagles. And probably must be the best decision they ever made. I mean, they just wanted the guitarist originally, though. They just wanted Lindsey.
Yeah,
and he was like, I'm bringing my girlfriend along if I'm joining, we're a package deal. But then we were talking about bands being a bit EastEndersy in the Fear Factory bit.
Oh, God, yeah.
Fleetwood Mac wrote the book on it.
Yeah, for sure.
They were all, at some point, married to each other and then split up and having affairs with each other's wives. And rumours is all the better for it.
And this is why Go Your Own Way always strikes me as the fucking weirdest choice for a wedding band to play.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Like, it's a request as well.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, which couple was it falling apart in Go Your Own Way?
That was Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah.
Most of that album was Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham's fallout. But basically, which song was it she put on there? Dreams was her first. I'm going to write this about this breakup, and it's quite an optimistic sort of song. And Lindsey Buckingham came back with Go Your Own Way, which was a bit of a brutal kickback. You know, no, it's not going to be all right. You know,
yeah,
fuck off. So she then tried to come back with Silver Springs, right. Which he insisted was a B-side.
Gosh.
I think it was just put on the reissues a few years back, basically. And then Tusk, it was basically like Lindsey pretty much taking over the band. He'd got into punk.
Right.
So he was. There's some really sort of harsh guitar sounds on there and that kind of thing. But then they sort of went a bit weird, and then in the 80s you got them going massive again with the Tango in the Night album, which is the one that's got Everywhere on it, and I think Big Love's on there as well, which are sort of, I suppose that with the 70s stuff had a massive sort of resurgence the last few years, with influencing sort of a lot of younger up and coming bands.
I was going to say, have you heard the track on the How to Destroy Angels album, which sounds a lot like Fleetwood Mac?
No.
Ice Age.
Okay. I think I've got that album, but hardly ever listened to it. That's
the whole album.
Nine Inch Nails, well, it's Trent Reznor and his wife, side project, isn't it, basically?
And Atticus as well.
Oh, yeah, so Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, basically. But it's really, the whole album's really, really brooding and electronic, and then it just breaks out into this song, which is just got a really nice little plinky plonky industrial acoustic guitar and this really Stevie Nicks vocal line.
Well, Lindsey Buckingham played guitar on Hesitation Marks, the last Nine Inch Nails record.
Did he?
Yes.
Did
he? And he also, the Sound City record that Dave Grohl put together for the documentary, where he got loads of different musicians collaborating on it, has got, I don't know if, I can't remember if that was before Hesitation Marks or after. I think it might have been just before.
Yeah, I think so.
Because that's got Trent Reznor on there.
Yeah.
But it's also got Stevie Nicks on another track and Lindsey Buckingham on another track.
Ah.
So I'm wondering if that's how the connection sort of things were made.
Oh, I think it must be.
But he's an amazing guitarist. There's a Big Love, was a massive single in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of full band, quite synthy type thing. But there's a live version, which will be on the playlist, definitely.
Yeah, that's phenomenal, that is.
Yeah,
where it's
to
all
that.
Finger-picking. It's just him
it's
solo.
Spanish guitarist.
Yeah, well, he plays... It's quite a weird guitar that he plays. And I think it's got nylon strings.
Yeah.
Or the one that he's got nylon and steel strung version, but I think the version he's doing on that sounds like it's a nylon one.
No, I liked that live version, sort of really bluesy. Just I thought that was way better than, you know, the 80s pop production with the stupid breathy backing vocals.
Well, they're kind of dated now, the 80s, but that's because they were the sound of, like, the present at the time.
Yeah.
And it's 30 years later now. But they've influenced so many, like, new bands, like Florence and the Machine, Haim, Rilo, Kiley, Lissy. They're all really, you know, they're really... There was that advert a few years ago with the horse dancing.
See, I was out the other night with Tim, my punk other half, and his sister, and they literally ganged up on me for not liking Rumours. I mean, even Tim recognises that it's a classic album.
He's right.
You know, and he what he said about it, he said it was the right album at the right time.
Yeah.
And so I felt like I need to be a bit more open-minded about Fleetwood Mac.
I mean, the Chain on that album is amazing.
That is infectious, I have to admit.
I'm going to have to admit that for years, I didn't know it was them.
Right.
B, thought that the bit from the Formula One
Yeah.
You know, the middle section, I thought that was the start of the song.
Yes.
So when someone told me, like, yeah, it's Fleetwood Mac, it's this song, and I was listening to it going,
no, it isn't.
No, that's not
fuck
it.
Fuck all, like, what are you on about? And then it got
until
to that.
About 4 minutes in.
So this outro is... Ah, that's interesting.
That was...
Because it basically is a completely different song,
yeah.
That bit, isn't
there
it?
There were, I think there's about 3 or 4 songs that they sort of glued together in the same way that, like, Queen did with Bohemian Rhapsody.
I like how it does it. It reminded me of, like, you know, the end section, not directly, but you know the end section of Mr. Blue Sky?
Yes.
By ELO, the way that comes in, you're like, where the fuck did that
Yeah, well, I think that's another one. It's like song cycles, isn't it, where there's a different sort of sections all added together.
Yeah.
Which, I've always wanted to write something like that, and I've never actually got round to it. I will do it at some point. But it's... I think that was probably the first Fleetwood Mac song that I was aware of, but I didn't know it was Fleetwood Mac. I just knew when I was about 6 and I was riding around on my mate's go-kart, we were riding around singing it because it was the Formula One music.
Yeah. That's it. The first time I picked up a bass, I was like, dung, like, dung, dung, dung. Yes! Yes! There we are.
Is it weirdly, I don't think it's connected. I was trying to sort of look it all up, but the Children of God cult was also known as The Chain.
Ooh.
But I couldn't find any reference anywhere of it being connected in any way.
That's interesting.
So, but I think it's a coincidence, unfortunately.
I don't know, it seems like a big coincidence.
It does, doesn't it? Because, yeah.
Yeah.
Although it does, you know, the lyrics are related to it, and it does fit in with everything else on that album of, you know, them all breaking up and getting back together. And
maybe it's a question that no one has ever asked.
Yes, we should find them. Let's find Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
All you have to do is go to LA, find a cocaine dealer, ask them where Stevie Nicks lives, and he'll go, it's that big weird house on the hill up there with all the flowing, like, scarves and everything.
Absolutely.
See, I don't like Stevie Nicks' voice that much.
I do.
I feel I should. It's almost country leaning, but I don't know. I just find it a bit whiny. And I don't like Christine McVie's voice either. So I'm kind of onto a loser
like,
with.
They don't like you.
They told me that you were a prick. So you know.
What about Lindsay Buckingham's voice then?
I like that more.
Yeah, even when he's doing his really weird noises and stuff occasionally. He does on that live version of Big Love. He does some weird noises at the end.
I got it on. I was in the other room doing something, and I could hear it, but not.
Yeah.
I need to re-listen to that.
It's definitely worth doing.
I mean, add that one to your Ian Bingo card.
Yes.
I need to re-listen to that.
I've not actually done my homework and listened to this one.
Fuck off.
So.
I have an encyclopedic knowledge of music.
Yes.
That I've listened to.
Yes. But you have to listen to it to know about it.
Yeah, right.
I think we'll probably leave that for there now.
Yeah, leave that for there now.
Leave that for there now.
So let's do that.
That was the letter F. So that means that the next one is the letter G.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about Goblin.
I wish we were. I've seen Goblin live. They were awesome.
Yeah, you know what we should have done? We should have done Goblin and then the other band that's Goblin related, Goblin Cock, who I have a CD by.
I've seen it if it's the one I'm thinking of. Google that, not on a work computer.
Yeah, never. And remember to spell gobbling properly. Not gobbling, goblin. Because that's going to lead you down a really, really... might like that.
So I think what we might do next time is rather than talk about Goblin and Goblin Cock, I think we'll talk about John Grant and Guns N' Roses.
And GBH.
And Gun.
Word up. So thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye. Bye.